Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nobel Prize winner James Watson of Watson and Crick fame of DNA and the epic discovery of DNA's double helix structure carries one of the most storied names in modern science. Right up there with Einstein, Robert Oppenheimer, Marie Curie, his pioneering work broke open the great age of genetic science we live in now. He's a science god, but also a bit of a gossip, a wag, an academic empire builder, an iconoclast. Now the great man has written a memoir and self-help book about how to get ahead in this world. Up next, On Point, James Watson on how to climb the slippery double helix of life. Joining me now in the studio is James Watson. In 1962, he shared the Nobel Prize for revealing the structure of DNA. He went on to teach at Harvard, where he spent the better part of two decades. From 1968 to 1993, Watson served as the director of the world-renowned Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory on Long Island, New York, and made it an international center for research in molecular biology. He continues there as chancellor. His many honors include the Presidential Medal of Freedom and the National Medal of Science. His new memoir is entitled Avoid Boring People: Lessons from a Life in Science. James Watson, welcome. Wonderful to have you here.
It's very nice to be here.
What a story. What a life in science. And after all that, you turn around to give us life lessons. It seems so mundane.
When I was young, I always wanted, advice as to what to do next and how to stay out of trouble. So I've tried to give some rules for staying out of trouble.
That's very generous for a Nobel Prize winner to turn around and do that. Have you found people have come to you in the course of your life for just that kind of advice? Young scientists wanting to know, how can I make a mark like James Watson?
Not really. I think people are slightly nervous about asking for advice because it would imply they don't know how to live.
Yes, and I suppose a lot of us feel that way a lot of the time.
And I never had rules given to me, except for the Ten Commandments. That was about it. And, I've tried to follow the Ten Commandments.
Well, we've got a lot more than that here, and we're going to get into them. Hannah Gray of University of Chicago, your early alma mater, writes in the foreword here that the freshness and candor of your observations on people and events, accomplishments and follies, including your own, may well derive from the novelty, she writes, that you have found in every experience that, new to you, made life more interesting. I mean, this is a kind of an attitude toward life.
Well, I've sought out, interesting people, interesting books, interesting movies, so I want to be better off for having done something.
Let's start out with the advice that you put right in the title, avoid boring people. Now, for someone who travels in your circles, you're a Nobel Prize winner. Is that an issue? Is that a problem?
Oh, sure. A good rule is everyone over 40 is boring. It was true when I was young, and I'm over 40. So the title, boring could be an adjective. I mean, a verb as well as an adjective.
So don't bore people.
Don't bore people. Mm. And I'm at the age when, when I was teaching at Harvard, I didn't want to bore them. And, of course, one way of not boring others is not bore yourself.
Never be the brightest person in the room. You discovered the double helix. You got a Nobel Prize and the Medal of Science and all the rest. How easy is it not to be the smartest person in the room,
well,
James
I never
Watson?
Felt I was the smartest. I think success came from surrounding myself with bright people and delegating power to very competent people. And first, my students at Harvard, they were quite a lot. And, they worked for themselves, and I didn't put my name on their papers, and their glory rubbed off on me.
Okay, let's say we've got a room. It's full of people. Maybe you're at the University of Chicago. Maybe you're at Cold Springs Harbor. Maybe you're at Harvard. How long does it take you to figure out who the smartest people in the room are? How do you do it?
Well, you listen to them. I think you can generally figure it out in 30 seconds.
Give us the telltale signs. I mean, we've all been hoodwinked.
If something is, stupid, immediately hear the word crap.
and the meter goes off, and you know it.
And, I think I was probably born with the excess of dopamine, so I react very fast.
I love it. You say, avoid gatherings of more than two Nobel Prize winners. Why? Are they boring?
Well, first of all, they're old, and they probably haven't done anything for the last 30 years. And so they're not always, but in many cases, resting on their past glory. You often don't get a Nobel Prize for 10 to 20 years and sometimes 30 after your discovery. And then you may have the prize for another 20 years. So you're not seeing people close to their moments for which they've become famous.
We'll look at more of your advice in this book, but tell us, I mean, for decades now, you've worn around your neck, Nobel Prize winner with Crick and crew, discoverer of the double helix. Has that been a blessing? Has it been a curse? How do you look at the laurels that came with your very early work in genetic science?
Oh, it's been a great blessing because it gave me a job at Harvard. If I hadn't got found the double helix, I wouldn't have. I'd been someplace out in the boondocks. I was placed in the company. I got a job with Bright People. And I wanted to come to Harvard for Caltech because I was not married, and I wanted to find a bright wife. So I thought, a Harvard student is what I will aim for.
One of the things I love about this is the way you really have no compunction about wearing your life ambition on your sleeve. I mean, you wanted to discover great things. You wanted to do great things and be recognized for it.
Well, the University of Chicago president, Robert Hutchins, who was perhaps our country's last great college president. When we went to Chicago, he said the aim of a Chicago education is to prepare you for your greatness.
There's a lot of expectation in that.
You read the great books, and you were, your aim was to write a great book after you read the great books. So that's sort of been the way I was raised. That Chicago wasn't preparing you to make money; it was to prepare you to understand the world and its people, and to be responsible to the world and do something new.
When you did something so new right in the early 1950s and then won the Nobel Prize on top of that, was your family surprised or did they think, no, that's just James? That's Jim. He was always on the path for a Nobel Prize.
I was a very, pretty ordinary kid. My teachers had a higher respect to me than I did of myself. I never thought I was going to be very bright or because I wanted to know what my IQ was. And it wasn't much better than 120 when I think it might have improved between the ages of 10 and 20 because I think I got better. But, I wasn't raised as a prodigy. No one had much expectations. I wanted to be a naturalist. I thought I'd be out in Montana or Colorado.
Following birds, deep in nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then at the university, when I was still 17, I read the book What is Life, which said, what is life, when I was growing up? That was one of the big questions. Now we don't ask it anymore because we see how life came about through DNA. And not that we know all the mysteries, but it's not, just a total black box. And so that was a very big thing for me because, most people thought, life comes from God, but I never thought that. So where did it come from? It had to come out of DNA or, some molecule which carried the instructions for life.
But that's a very interesting observation coming from you, Nobel Prize winner, co-discoverer of the double helix. Have you ruined the mystery of life with your own endeavor to understand it?
Well, that's I think the big mystery is over. But there's the mystery of the brain, which is probably going to prove more difficult to crack. So there's something very important for, you know, the future young kids can think, gee, maybe I will be the one who will crack the brain.
The big mystery is over. We get genetic science and the double helix and the sequence, DNA sequencing and all the rest, and that's it? That's all there is? Let's keep dancing?
You know, seeing what our lack of knowledge was when I was, entered college in 1943, biology was, you know, descriptive science with no basic understanding of what was up. You know, the physics and chemistry, you know, bright people went into that sort of biology was, you know, for those who couldn't make it in chemistry and physics.
Yeah.
But now, you know, biology is a real challenge, even to physicists.
Let's take a call from John in Gloucester, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air with James Watson. Hello, John. Are you there, my friend?
Yes, I'm there. Hi.
Hi.
I very much enjoyed, first of all, it's an honor to be talking to both of you. I very much enjoyed the article as well in MIT's Technology Review, where many of these things about avoiding boring people were listed. But you also mentioned something very interesting with regard to the timing of one's vision for what you're pursuing. And you talked about to pick something that was considered not ripe or not ready yet, 2 to 3 years in advance. And I'm thinking now about the current technological year and how things happen so fast in a matter of months, whereas many of the things that happened in your discovery happened over the course of of snail mail letters and trips on boats across the ocean and so forth. What is your advice with regard to setting one's vision in the current compressed time of emails and internet and blogs and so forth of this nature?
Oh, John, that's such a great question. James Watson.
I think it's moved to a field where there aren't a lot of people in it. Say, RNAi, inhibitory RNA. Boy, things move fast there.
Ribonucleic acid inhibitory, meaning?
Yes. It turns off gene function.
Okay. And everybody's crammed around that, so don't go to that pole?
Yeah. Your chance of having a relaxing summer is pretty small. So go for something where it's a big objective, but most people think it's premature.
So when you scan the horizon, give us some ideas. Like what right now?
I'd probably go for the genetics of behavior. It doesn't still move that fast. And you know you'll get results.
Genetics of behavior, for example, that mean like who I don't know.
You know, why are the Swedes, why don't they talk more?
So really right down to how DNA sequences might control the way we behave.
I think most people think... you know, it's not politically correct. So I would go into a field which is politically incorrect, scientifically incorrect, because most people won't dare go near it.
How do you know you don't end up in a giant pothole? Larry Summers, former president of Harvard, brought up, you know, the possibility of some genetic gender link to to capacity or propensity for science and math, and boom, he was out.
Well, I don't think that it certainly didn't make his life easier, but I think if he just made a lot of friends on the Harvard faculty, he'd still be here.
So you write in your book, it's interesting about this one academic leader in particular, that there may be a genetic reason for this sort of personality that had him at sword points with so many people that set the stage for his departure.
Yeah. So, you know, it's, you know, hard to think of where the next great discoveries will come. But, you know, just thinking about it, human behavior is supposedly totally within our control. And so saying we're not as free as we think we are is you're not supposed to say this in a university environment. So you won't have much competition now.
John raises the issue of timing, and timing is a big theme throughout your book. And one thing you continually emphasize, it's already come up, is youth. You say to young people, perhaps scientists, when you're still an undergraduate, begin to define your target. It's not too early, and go fast because the advantages of youth are so enormous.
Yeah. For one thing, you probably, you know, don't have children, and so you can work on Saturdays, and you won't be thought bad because you're not helping your wife with the babies. And so when I was pursuing the structure of DNA, I was bored much of the time when I was doing it because nothing was happening, but I remained focused on just one thing. And so when you go for something, don't do it unless you're almost obsessed about it, because it's so easy to get diverted. And while you're diverted, someone who's obsessed about the subject will get there first.
You say two obsessions are one too many. It's one obsession, and go with that.
Yeah. And I was certainly lucky there were effectively no girls in Cambridge, England when I was there. So there was no way to be, you know.
So nature's obsession wasn't available.
No. So when I think back about it, you know, I returned to my old staircase and there were women living on it. I just think, you know.
Things might have been different.
Might have been different.
There goes the Nobel Prize flying off in a cloud of summer dresses.
Yeah, no, I was, you know, very interesting. I think Tom Stoppard could write a play about it. Why Linus Pauling didn't find the structure of DNA, despite his immense knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he was obsessed by DNA. He just knew it, but he wasn't obsessed. And I think further, he probably must have been depressed, because it was as if his brain wasn't there. And when you're depressed, your dendrites contract, and you don't really have your full powers.
So your natural dopamine, then, is another maybe genetic gift. Maybe this is part of your James Watson's behavior package that led you.
Yeah,
where you're
going. Think, you know, that I just want to move fast, and slow-moving people, you know, I just stay away from them.
Enough said. You say stay in close with your intellectual competitors. Now, describe how you actually do that. Do they know that you're there as a rival, as a competitor?
Well,
are you chewing into their intellectual flesh as you stay close to them, or disguising your agenda?
When we were working on DNA, there was London, and Francis and I in Cambridge. And the knowledge that Linus Pauling at Caltech was bound to have a go at.
Was in the race, yeah.
So it was a three-person race.
Mm-hmm.
And never get in a 20-person race.
Mm-hmm. Make it a small one. Have huge objectives that make you feel special, you say.
Yes. So the only way to have few competitors is to be ahead of time.
But this struck me as well. Even when you're in the company of people smarter than yourself, even when you're James Watson, even when you're staying close to your intellectual competitors, you say banal thoughts necessarily also dominate clever minds. So don't expect genius all the time.
No, I mean, you know, suddenly you're having lunch with your hero and you discover that he's pretty ordinary.
They're gossiping about so-and-so's new girlfriend,
yeah,
the regular stuff.
You know, they're doing anything possible not to have to think.
But then it comes in lightning bolts. Why are some people open to that and others are not? Why, you know, some maybe banal over lunch, but after lunch they discover the double helix.
I think I'm a very curious person, and I want to know why something happens, not just what happens. And so I collect facts, hoping that an unexpected fact will provide the why for another fact.
But you're also very clear. You say it's not the what ultimately, it is the why. The facts are so understand the why.
Yeah, but one of my rules is new ideas usually require new facts.
Yeah. Fresh fodder.
Yeah, so when we found the DNA structure, I probably knew more facts about DNA than anyone else.
And so the pattern comes together, that twisting ladder. We have so many listeners who want to speak with you, James Watson. Let's keep to them. Dennis is calling from Panama City, Florida. Dennis, you're on the air with James Watson.
Professor Watson, it's an honor. My question is about the discovery of the double helix. I believe it was a documentary, The Drug Years, that said that when you and Francis discovered this, that you guys were on LSD.
No, I think LSD didn't exist at that time. I think there were no drugs in the Cambridge scene in the early 50s. Francis Crick did sign a petition, the only petition I think he ever signed in his life, when the Rolling Stones got busted in the early 60s, I think for the legalization of pot.
Was that whole movement ever of interest to you, Timothy Leary and all the rest, sort of right in the heart of your early career? The drug scene was exploding.
No, I have never felt the need for stimulants. Maybe I'm sort of self-stimulated. My father was an obsessive smoker and died of lung cancer. And I probably didn't like the smell of cigarettes, and I just didn't want to go near them when I, you know, reached adulthood.
James Watson on A Natural High. Angel's calling from Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. Angel, you're on the air with Dr. Watson.
Hi, Dr. Watson. Such an honor to be able to speak with you. I understand what you're saying about trying to be original in this type of thing, but what you find out is I'm actually an applied biologist. I'm a plant breeder. And what you find out is that when you try to apply for grants or when you're trying to get tenure or you're trying to get promotions, there is a whole body of people who will say, your project's not basic enough, or you're working on a minor crop, or we already know this isn't going to work. You know, it makes it very difficult to really do original research when you're trying to, when you've got to face your peers and other administrators that already have their mind made up.
No, I think science isn't as much fun as when I went into it, because soon after I went into it, there was a lot of money for science and not many scientists. Now there's a lot of science and the money not adequate to keep the system going. So I'm very distressed that the Democrats coming into power really doesn't look like it's going to make any difference. They're not very interested in science or ideas.
Interesting. Not even the Democrats, by your lights.
Yeah, I was born, you know, my mother was a precinct captain for the...
In Chicago, so yeah, we're talking the, Democrat.
Yeah, really Irish Democrat. And, you know... You know, I just think of Armani Democrats. And removed from the world, the United States, I think to stay great power, has to generate new knowledge. We're pretty good at generating entertainment, but we've also got to generate the knowledge, which, you know, has made our country very wealthy.
But why on earth would that impulse go away? All Americans know that that's been absolutely critical to the prosperity and... you know, sort of boundary-breaking
of
this
nation.
Well, you
know, there are very few Jewish kids going into science now. Harvard has 1,000 economics undergraduate majors.
Investment bankers in the making or,
yeah.
I don't know, hedge fund, I don't know.
Yeah, I think if you look at the scientific career, as the last questioner said, it's a grind with, you know, uncertain outlook whether you're ever going to make it.
But it certainly doesn't sound as though it's been a grind for you. You're saying just a different era.
It was a different era, and now we're even more important. But the numbers are large, and we're unbelievably underfunded. Now all, you know, I don't even go to Washington. I just go toward... very rich people who might keep the system going.
It's amazing. You've spent a lot of time after your, many of your own research breakthroughs guiding others. And you talk a lot in the book about how best to do that. You say, for example, Cold Spring Harbor Labs and beyond, you say, manage your scientists like a baseball team. This is very much in the headlines, right? Everybody's thinking baseball this month. So what do you mean, manage scientists like a baseball team?
Well, if they, you've got to have some home run hitters. So you've got to have a constantly changing team. You can't have the same team for 10 years. And there are very few Roger Clements, you know, that people make it into their 40s. And
so send them back to the farm league if you don't see great
promise.
No,
I think they should, you know, do something else. Or, you know, I went to Cold Spring Harbor when I was 40. I became a manager of science, you know, rather than doing it. And I totally enjoyed it. So being a manager didn't mean I couldn't have fun. But I realized the people who had to be there at night, who were there on the Saturdays, who worked on Sundays, were going to be the young people.
You say straight up, no one can long remain a science manager unless constantly on the prowl for talented rookies. And your heads up to those who are a little older, only individuals who continually reinvent themselves through new ways of thinking should enter middle age, still part of your staff. Wow.
Yeah.
Just out you go. I love this one. Then you say, make necessary decisions before you have to.
That's probably the biggest mistake of leaders. They postpone decisions and just wait. And then I'd rather make a decision fast, because if you make it early, you can change your mind. If you wait too long, you can't even change your mind when you've made a mistake. So I assume you're going to make mistakes, and just get it out and see what you got. And if it doesn't work, change course.
You say don't give up in an academic setting. This would be, I guess, but maybe others. Don't give up on teaching. Continue teaching, because you write, teaching can make your mind move on to big problems. Why?
Well, because, you know, I had to teach sort of general courses at Harvard. Now, you know, the hotshot scientists, oh, you only have to teach about your own subject. That means you... you know, unless you're reinventing yourself, you just stay the same old thing. So, you know, having to teach economics per se, you know, freshman courses as opposed to advanced courses, really makes you have a sense of priority. What should people go out of the university knowing?
Ladies and gentlemen, you don't get nitty-gritty advice like this every day from a Nobel Prize winner, James Watson, least. I mean, there's some way down. You say, avoid being photographed if you're an academic or science leader, unless it's with Muhammad Ali or Lance Armstrong. Put somebody else out front who's doing something. And then this, you say, never dye your hair.
Well, that's really for a man. I'm not asking a woman to
what's
have
that have
gray
to do?
Hair
does,
at 50.
Does hair dye cut into your IQ somehow or what?
No, it just looks phony. You know, and particularly when you have thin hair, to try and make it red to hide the fact that, you know. Once I saw Strom Thurmond and his dyed hair.
It only took once. Right?
You know, it's enough to make me think whenever I see another Strom Thurmond mimic. You know, it's ridiculous.
I love it. James Watson writes, contrary to our present national ethos, it's better to act younger than you look, rather than the reverse. That's terrific. Just great.
You know, you can see some men 60 with solid black hair. You just don't trust them.
Yeah, well, okay. Mike is calling from Beaufort, North Carolina. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Watson. It's an honor to speak with you. If I may maybe argue with one point, you said that life's mystery is pretty much solved with RNA, DNA, and it seems to me that it's sort of like when blood was discovered to be circulating through a body, or microbes to be doing their little things, at each point a frontier is crossed. But to me, life's mystery is still basically unsolved. That's a comment. The question was, how do you trade off youthful intellectual rigor with wisdom that comes from experience? According to your advice, if we saw you in a room, we should avoid you.
Because he's 79, so move on.
Well, you should hear me talking, saying something you don't expect. And so when I talk to college students, I try and not upset them, but I try and make them think in different ways. So, I'm sure I bore some people, but, I'm not boring myself now.
And what about the trade-off? Mike refers to what we often think of youth, you know, dazzling kind of fireworks of intellectual acrobatics, age, wisdom. Do you buy that?
Yes. You should just give young people, you know, from sometimes even when they're in the university, a real chance to do something by themselves, not be seen as assistants, and to realize, you know, Alexander the Great conquered the world, you know, and by the time he's 21. And
you say go for it early. But I have to say, James Watson, when I read you, you seem to give a lot more weight and love to youth than to the wisdom of age. Do I misinterpret?
Yeah, well, you know, it's more fun watching Roger Federer play tennis now than John McEnroe. So, you know, McEnroe still can hit a good shot, but, you know, if you, you know.
Yeah, no, we've got it loud and clear.
It may not be true in, you know, writing novels, where mm-hmm. if you could write your great novel at 60, it's very unusual to do great science after 40.
Lynn is calling from Greenwich, Connecticut. Lynn, you're on the air with James Watson.
Hello. Thank you very much, Dr. Watson. It's more of an experience that I wanted to mention. When I was 6 years old, my mother took all of her children, myself included, to, I believe you were lecturing at UCLA. And even though I was 6 at the time, you were so inspirational. You just showed people who would or would not go into the scientific field that there is a wonderful world, and use your curiosity. I always led my life that way. Next, the next time I ran into, or I was fortunate enough to meet you, my mother, my father, and I, and you welcomed us into your office, and we recalled this experience to you, and you got a good chuckle out of that.
Was that in Cold Spring Harbor or where,
Lynn? That was in Cold Spring Harbor,
mm-hmm.
and this was about 2 years ago. But I just wanted to mention, Dr. Watson, you are so inspiring. You bring the scientific world to people who will never have a scientific mind or be able to understand it. You make it interesting. You make people use their mind and think about things differently. You did that for me as a 6-year-old, and now at 36, I'm trying to instill that to my children. So thank you for bringing that inspiration, and thank you for sharing it with the world. We really appreciate it.
That's wonderful.
Well,
Liz.
Thank you. I can't thank you enough.
Your way is strewn with rose petals here, yeah. James Watson. You must have had a lot of this in your life. I mean, people see the discovery. They see the Nobel Prize. You do speak in a lively, kind of inspiring way. Was this a big pleasure to you? What do you make of the adulation and...
Oh, I'm a bit uncomfortable, you know, when people say they're honored to be with me, you know, I'm honored to be with them. You know, I had a few very lucky breaks in my life, and it set me apart from other people. But, you know, my aspirations, I think, are very similar to those of most Americans.
Let's hope so. Jacob's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Jacob, you're on the air with James Watson.
Pleasure, sir, both of you. I had a quick question, which was during the early 50s when you were, on the brink of this earth-shattering discovery, did it ever give you a sense of dread? And you touched on this a little bit earlier, Tom, I think, but... in the sense that in today's day and age where there's genome mapping and, people are speculating about genome surveillance, people, it opens a whole new realm of vulnerability of the average global citizen to insurance companies, to governments, to structuring of policies, of products, of behavioral monitoring, down to, insurance companies denying someone coverage at the age of 6 because they say, well, when you're 43, you're going to have a heart attack, or to even more dreadful possibilities, things like when you start drawing genetic differences down racial and cultural lines, having rival governments or groups targeting groups of people with differences that they deem unfit to be here.
Jacob, we get it, the dreaded double edge of scientific discovery. James Watson, what do you say to it?
I think we'll be freer with genetic knowledge than without it.
Can you explain
your
why?
DNA, well,
why do you believe that? It's heartening to have that, to hear that opinion, but I'm curious how you come to it.
Well, it's as if discrimination will only start when we get genetic knowledge, whereas our life is... discrimination isn't a bad thing because, you have to choose one thing over another. That's what the word means. It's unfair discrimination, which is bad. And that happens all the time today. I think the mentally ill are terribly discriminated against, but once we understand them, I think they will fit into society and we will know how to handle their problems much better. So I look forward to more knowledge. Of course, you can worry about your genetic records being seen, but, you know, I think presidents have always had someone to break in an office to get the information they want, and they'll probably find a good reason for doing it. And, of course, we should be very vigilant against it.
But I want to stick with Jacob's question for a moment. I mean, you raise some key issues in the book which seem and go on to say they're going to be very difficult to deal with. For example, you're talking about genetic factors determining human intellectual abilities, and
yes,
you predict that they'll soon be much better known, to the point that you say it's too much to assume that that there are differences between peoples who came from geographic different parts of the world, which sounds like a euphemism for race potentially. We may learn things that are entirely un-PC. You describe Derek Bach, former president of Harvard, coming to you and saying, James, how long until we know this? He seemed to dread knowing it. And you said 15 years. You later recalculated and said maybe 10.
I think this knowledge won't lead to greater discrimination. I think it...
You say, are wanting to reserve equal powers of reason as some universal heritage of humanity will not be enough to make it so. I mean, that's been the third rail for a long... That whole idea has been the third rail.
But I don't know what the answer will be. I don't know really what the innate intelligence of the Australian Aborigines is. And all I know is that they have a miserable life now and can't seem to fit in any world that we can imagine. And that's terrible. And that, you know, my parents probably could have saved a lot of money not giving me piano lessons because I don't think I have any musical talent whatsoever.
But was it lost on you? Perhaps you enjoy piano more? I mean, if in 10 years your heir is going to lay out everybody's destiny sounds like a prison, but you say we'll be more free.
Because I don't believe anyone's DNA should be looked at unless you can help the person. I wouldn't, I don't think people should be sequenced at birth. There's one gene which would let you, you know, a doctor would say, I'd like to know this because mm-hmm. there's a treatment, I would do it.
Do you presume that benevolence in handling our genetic information will prevail?
Yes. I mean, it's more or less saying, do I think people are good or bad? You know, we have horror stories with our health system and the unfairness of it today. I can't imagine it any worse. You know, people not getting the treatment they should, the bureaucracy and everything. I think if we understand disease better, we'll be, you know, I have a mentally ill son. I didn't know how to treat him. I would like to know why he was mentally ill. I think knowing what he can't do would let me treat him better. And that really is the governing factor in my whole, you know, I wanted to start the Human Genome Project because I wanted to help my son.
Which illness?
Schizophrenia.
And here you are knowing so much and still not enough.
Yeah, not enough. So I just want more knowledge. And, you know, when I say we're not equal, a lot of us aren't equal. And... it would be better. It would have been better with my son not to have tried to send him to Exeter. was cruel, but mm-hmm. I didn't know it.
Who could know? But perhaps one day we will. Let's take a call from Kathleen in Boston. Kathleen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to ask Dr. Watson if you could please comment on the now-deceased researcher Rosalind Franklin, the X-ray crystallographer who is purported... found the structure of DNA herself. Did you know her?
Of course I knew her. But really
Where and when?
In Cambridge, England, but I knew her. I really only began to know her after we found the DNA structure. And we weren't close friends, but we were certainly friends until the time she died.
Did you and Crick step on this woman on your way to Nobel Prizes?
No, not... It sounds a cop-out, but just read chapter 6 of my new book, and I try and retell the story the way... I think Rosalind, she had great difficulty getting along, understanding other people. So she didn't know how to get help. The person who was going to give her the most help would have been Francis Crick. And if she'd told Francis a fact, he would have immediately said, this means two trains running in opposite directions, and the structure would be known as the Rosalind Franklin structure.
Is it possible to say anything useful about gender in science? Male, female, capacities? In the scientific pursuit.
No, Rosalind had all the abilities needed to solve the structure. I think she suffered in her inability to socially engage and get help from other people.
Take it up above Rosalind to the big gender question. At 79, looking back on a lifetime of working with scientists, male and female, do you see distinctions? Do you believe there are useful lines to be drawn or distinctions to be drawn or not?
I think... now, which they didn't have when I first went to Harvard, women have absolutely equal opportunity to be as great as they carry themselves. And so we won't settle the question of whether there's as many strange great mathematicians who are women as are men until women do great mathematics. I hope they do.
Will we settle it by genetic sequencing?
No, I don't think so. I don't think we'll ever understand genetics well enough. We might, because certainly the male brain is different from the female brain. Women get far less autism. Same genes, and they will be much less autistic in many cases.
And so then also less Asperger's, which many mathematicians
yes.
border into.
Yeah, so we don't know the connection. Mathematics is a real extreme because there's this connection between autism and mathematics, and it may be that women, you know, they're better protected not only against... autism, but what would go with it, an abnormal preoccupation of the, you know, devotional part of the brain to solving mathematical puzzles. I don't know the answer. I think we'll someday find it out. I don't think it's worth arguing about it. Right now, it's just for women to go into mathematics and show their superstars.
Should Harvard's recent president, Lawrence Summers, have lost his job over raising this issue, this possibility of distinction?
No, I don't think so. I would have supported him in raising the possibility, though I think if I'd been president, I wouldn't have done so. I think he also, like Rosalind Franklin, he's just awkward among people. And that sets you back. I mean, a person of great talent, but as if they never look at your face.
James Watson, you're 79. Your accomplishments in science are legendary. Speak to the 10-year-old listener who's out there right now, whether at this hour or later today, and they're thinking about a career, a life in science. What do you say to them, Nobel Prize winner?
It could be terribly exciting if you are both intelligent and lucky. Because, you know, I wouldn't be with you today if I hadn't been lucky in the sense that Linus Pauling stumbled, Rosalind didn't get the help she should have got. And so you need both. But
10 years old, listening to you.
Oh, I'd go into science, but that's my life, you know. I never wanted to, you know, be in business or something like that. Science is, it satisfies your curiosity.
What can be better for a human?
Yeah.
James Watson's new memoir is Avoid Boring People, Lessons from a Life in Science. Dr. Watson, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for coming in.
I'm very glad I've been with you.
It's just great. Thanks a lot. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Chris Burrell, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mm-hmm.